Welcome back to the program. It's been frequently said that Afghanistan has been the graveyard of empires. Certainly in modern times, the Soviet Union paid a heavy price for its adventurism in Afghanistan. Today, American lives and billions of dollars have been shed in the service of what may really be local, provincial, political interest inside that country. After 10 years, what do we really know about Afghanistan? Its links to international terror, and its role in the larger regional and geopolitical issues shaping its region and the world. We're going to talk about this today with a man who knows this country well. He is Edward Gerardet. He is a writer, journalist, producer who has reported widely from humanitarian and conflict zones in Africa, Asia, and elsewhere in the world since the late 1970s. He twice met Osama bin Laden. He's been a foreign correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor and U.S. News and World Report. It is my pleasure to welcome Edward Gerardet to this program to talk about his book, Killing the Cranes, A Reporter's Journey Through 3 Decades of War in Afghanistan. Edward, thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning.
One of the things that seems to run through the history of Afghanistan and so much that you write about is this consistent resistance to outside forces in that country.
Yeah, I think this has been, you know, one of the long traditions, and you do have to go back probably several thousand years. Many people have either invaded Afghanistan, passed through it, been kicked out, absorbed, and, you know, this went up also to the mid-19th century when the British invaded Afghanistan, got thoroughly beaten in their first war, the Anglo-Afghan War of 1842, when an expeditionary force of about 16,000 troops and camp followers were destroyed. They had 2 more wars, late 19th century, early 20th century, both very, very inconclusive, and of course leading up to the Soviet War in the 1980s. And basically the historic lesson is that Afghans are always willing and extremely hospitable to welcome guests in their country, but the moment you become an outsider who invades or tries to impose himself, then you're running into problems.
And I guess the corollary of that has been the efforts over and over again of these various forces that have invaded the country to create kind of centralization in the country, which has been resisted almost as much as outsiders have been.
Yeah, there's a saying in Afghanistan that every man is a king amongst kings, which means that everyone has the right to speak. You're on equal terms. And in fact, there was a British writer in the 1930s who came in to Afghanistan from Iran on the western border of Afghanistan, and he said, finally, a country without an inferiority complex. And I think that's very much who the Afghans are. It's a mixed nation. I refer to it as being a country, as a nation, but it's a very diverse nation of tribal Pashtuns in the east and the south, Tajiks, who are Mediterranean people in the north, Uzbeks, who are Mongolian-featured. You also have a minority Shia population, the Hazaras, who actually believe to be descendants of Genghis Khan, and so on and so forth. So you have a great mix. It's also topographically an extraordinary country with high mountains, you know, 20, 21,000-foot high mountains of the Hindu Kush, which is the extension of the Himalayas. You've got semi-arid, arid deserts, very rugged terrain. And as a country, it's also ideal guerrilla country.
Mm-hmm. How important is it to understand kind of the founding, go to the early 19th century and understand the founding of the modern state of Afghanistan in order to understand the country today?
Well, again, I think it's absolutely imperative to bring in the sense of history because by trying to impose from above and trying to impose from the outside is ludicrous. And that's what we did post-2001. It's also what the Soviets tried to do in the 1980s, what the British tried to do as well. Basically, the Afghans prefer to have control of their own regions. They've always wanted to have a weak Kabul, a weak capital city. They don't mind if Kabul deals with foreign affairs or other aspects, but the Afghans themselves want control of their own local or regional affairs. And it's also interesting to see that when President Karzai of Afghanistan today, when he appoints a minister, people actually want to become a governor of their region, not a minister.
Hmm. You arrived in Afghanistan initially about 3 months prior to the Soviet invasion in 1979. Talk a little bit about what the country was like at that point.
Well, I had actually traveled through as a student between school, high school, and university on my way to India. I had sort of whipped through Afghanistan, had always been impressed by the terrain, the people, you know, traveling by bus in these multicolored buses, very hospitable people. When I went back as a journalist, actually the first time as a journalist in October 79, I really didn't know much about Afghanistan politically. I knew there was a war brewing, it was spreading, there was a communist regime in Kabul which was being supported by the Soviets, and I forced myself as this young reporter to take the bus from Peshawar in Pakistan to Kabul because I'd heard that you know, there were attacks every 2 or 3 days against the road, snipers shooting tourists, government officials being murdered, buses being, you know, blown up. So I was incredibly nervous, but really felt I had to do it by road because that's what a good reporter does, to give you a sense. Of course, nothing happened. And I also, by the way, called that chapter A Coward in Afghanistan because I felt as a writer I had to admit that I did feel pretty nervous about going there. Of course, when I got to Kabul, by then all the tourists had gone. During the late 70s, there'd been a lot of tourists, Americans, Europeans. You know, they were on the Hashish Trail, on the Kathmandu Trail. But all those people had gone practically. And all that was left were these Soviet advisors, military, also East European advisors who made it very clear that they did not like the Soviets or the East German secret police, by the way, who were also training up the Afghans with their own secret police, which had its impact later on. But then I flew out because I felt I wanted to see the terrain, and then I realized, you know, I was no expert in guerrilla warfare, but I just looked down from the plane window, and I just thought, this is what ideal guerrilla country must be like.
One of the things that you witnessed in the country also is really a mass exodus of refugees from the country that happened in the late 80s, early 90s. Talk a little bit about that and the impact that that had on the country.
Well, it became the world's largest refugee flight population. Over 5 million people fled Afghanistan, 3 million to Pakistan, the rest to Iran and to other countries. Also, a lot of educated people. I mean, precisely the people you wanted to keep, they also left as well. So there were all these camps strung out along the Pakistani border from north to south. I visited a lot of the camps. I also, when I went inside Afghanistan with the Mujahideen or with the French doctors who were volunteering humanitarian support for the civilian populations inside, I would constantly come across refugees fleeing by foot. Now, you've got to imagine, this is... You know, a lot of them came from the city. They'd never, you know, they were not fit. They'd never actually gone like that in the countryside. But they literally walked from Kabul across the desert, across the mountains, into Pakistan. And you would constantly meet these people. And, you know, I was incredibly touched because they were fleeing, and yet they always came up to you and shook your hand. And they always said, you know, please tell the world what's going on here. And even at one point, I was with a friend of mine, another journalist. We were absolutely exhausted. We were heading back to Pakistan in the mountains, a lot of refugees. It was nighttime, little fires dotted around, and we had just resigned ourselves to having no food for the next 2 days. And I was dreaming of a cup of tea, and suddenly this old man walked up to us with this little silver tray with two glasses of tea on it, even with sugar, which was a luxury, and he gave it to us. And he said, you know, we know that you're journalists, and we feel you have to tell the world what's happening. Take this tea. And of course, you know, we pretended to refuse it, but I really did not want to refuse it. But I was extremely touched. It just showed that even with utmost despair, these people still retain their dignity.
Talk about the Mujahideen and really the rise of them and the role that they've played.
Well, the Mujahideen, you had two types. You had what were known as the inside fronts. These were commanders who'd risen up inside Afghanistan. They represented maybe a valley or a region. They had their own, you know, sources. Some were highly effective as commanders. Others were not. In Peshawar, Pakistan, you had the Peshawar resistance politicians who were supported by the Americans, the Pakistanis, the Chinese. These guys were the ones who channeled all the outside aid to the Mujahideen. But of course, this is all under the direction of the Pakistanis, and a lot of the aid disappeared before it actually reached the inside. I tried to travel with different groups, because what I realized very soon after working in Afghanistan was that while you may visit one particular region, this was not representative of Afghanistan. This was representative of that particular part of Afghanistan. So you really had to travel with the different groups, with Pashtuns, with Tajiks, with Uzbeks, in order to get a sense of what was happening in Afghanistan. And I would walk inside, as did, you know, we were probably all in all 20 or 30 Western journalists who went on a regular basis to Afghanistan, no more than that, even at the height of the Soviet war. And, you know, we would disappear for weeks on end inside. We would trek 14, 16 hours a day. We had horse caravans. I mean, we kept all our film equipment on one horse, medical supplies on another, because, of course, as a Westerner, a lot of the locals thought you were a doctor practicing, you know, giving first aid to war victims. But you slept in villages, you slept in mosques, you were constantly talking to Afghans, and you also got a sense of which commanders were the good ones, which commanders were the ones with the local population. You know, so you really got a sense of what the country was like, what Afghans were like, and they in turn sort of respected or welcomed you because they realized that you were there just there on a trekking vacation.
And is this what the Soviets and later the U.S. has gotten so wrong in trying to understand Afghanistan, not really understanding the nuance, the bifurcation, all these things that you're talking about?
Well, for one thing, one has to remember that Afghans are Muslim. And the extraordinary thing, I'm not Muslim, but I couldn't help but admire these people who, even with absolutely nothing, would stop on some mountainside to pray to their God. And I think this is what really gave them an extraordinary strength, they and Allah, they and Islam. And this is something very difficult for outsiders to understand, that you cannot just go in there and impose, because these people have something else which you don't have. And so I think their belief in Islam was very, very strong, because the lowest of the low would sit beside, you know, the top commander, and they would be on equal terms. And I think that's very important. And secondly, they believed in their jihad against the Soviets and also today. And the difference between the Mujahideen of the 1980s and the armed opposition or the Taliban today is that they fought in a very similar manner. The only difference, I think, between the Mujahideen of the 80s and the Taliban of today and the other insurgent groups is that there is the foreign import, and this did not exist before, the foreign import of the suicide bomber or the IED, the booby trap bomb, indiscriminately used against civilians, against soldiers, against anyone else. More than half the casualties today are caused by IEDs. This was not the case during the 1980s when all the fighting was done by the guerrillas themselves. But when I look at the way the Taliban or the insurgents are operating, it is exactly the way the Mujahideen operated, save for this new concept of the suicide bomber.
You know, you talk about the jihad against the Soviets. It was in your first encounter with Osama bin Laden that he said to you, "This is not your jihad."
Exactly. I mean, I met this very tall Arab. There were quite a few Arabs in the eastern parts of Afghanistan fighting their jihad. I mean, it was the only jihad going in the world, so they flocked to Afghanistan. And of course, at the time, we didn't know who bin Laden was. It was only, you know, some years later that I found out. But he demanded to know what I was doing in the country, and exactly that point, this was not my jihad. And I tried to explain to him that I was a journalist and that I had been covering Afghanistan since the very beginning. And I also pointed out that, in fact, there were also a lot of Western aid workers, such as the French doctors, most of whom were women, also helping Afghans. And I sort of rather childishly or stupidly said, you know, and where were you? And we've been here since the very beginning. He didn't take to that too well.
Talk a little bit about the history of assassination in the country, though. You've written a lot about the fact that assassination has been a fact of life in the country for over 30 years.
Yeah, well, during the 80s, we, the Americans, the West, the Chinese, the Pakistanis, most of our support went to Islamic fundamentalists, extremists. In fact, a lot of those we supported during the are now fighting us today in Afghanistan, or their sons are. But what was happening is that you had one particular character called Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, who was an extremist and still is, and is now one of the leading opposition people to the U.S. and NATO in Afghanistan. Ruthless man. He killed off or assassinated quite a few people, hundreds of intellectuals, of resistance fighter or commanders who opposed him. And this concept of assassination was always quite strong, that anyone who really stepped out of line or became too prominent was basically done away with. Of course, the killing of Ahmad Shah Massoud, the Northern Alliance or United Front leader, the last really significant commander to oppose the Taliban in 2001, he was assassinated by two al-Qaeda operatives who I bumped into while trying to see Massoud. They were living in the room next to me. Of course, didn't know at the time who they were. They were posing as camera people for a Middle Eastern TV network. But the concept of assassination is something that has become nowadays much more prevalent. It's a way of getting rid of anyone who steps out. Also, during the Soviet war, a lot of the communists were assassinated by the Afghans and vice versa.
One of the things that also becomes clearer in understanding this is the influence that Pakistan and Pakistani leaders have had on Afghanistan. Talk a little about that.
Well, of course, I could have written a whole book on this as well and sort of touched on various aspects, but I think that's also a key factor to why things have proven to be such a disaster in Afghanistan. The Pakistanis, particularly ISI, which is the military intelligence organization, has been for years running its own agenda. And I think what is stunning is the fact that the CIA relied so heavily on ISI for their information, when quite clearly the Pakistanis have always had their own agenda, which was totally different from our own. Also, their main preoccupation is not Afghanistan, it's India, but Afghanistan enters into this overall equation. During the 80s, they wanted to have an Afghanistan they could control because the Soviets were sort of lukewarm, supported by the Indians as well, so that they did not want to have another front on their western flank. Nowadays, India is providing actually a lot of assistance to Afghanistan. The Indians see that as being a new realm of influence, which, by the way, is probably no different from what happened in the 19th century when British India sought to influence events inside Afghanistan. It was just that it was being run by the British, but it's still India. So Pakistan today, even with the killing of bin Laden, when the Pakistani government denied knowing about his presence, they may be right. But to my mind, I think to anyone who's worked in that region, there's no question that ISI or a component or rogue components of ISI were supporting bin Laden in one way or another. I mean, there's no way you could have someone like bin Laden living within 500 yards of the equivalent of West Point in Pakistan.
Right.
I mean, everyone knows everyone's business. I've tried many, you know, I've crossed into Afghanistan many times clandestinely, was convinced no one saw me, and I'd get arrested because there was always someone who could figure out who you were. I mean, their on-the-ground intelligence is very, very close.
And the Pakistani influence in Afghanistan, I mean, it goes back even to before the Soviet invasion to the late 70s, when Zia became president and had this vision of what he wanted to do with Afghanistan.
In fact, it even went before Zia to Bhutto. He began supporting Afghans against the Dawood regime, which is the regime before the communists came to power. So it went back to like 1975. But in fact, under Zia, he sought to influence events in Afghanistan, and through ISI, they tried to run everything. They tried to establish their own regime, And even when the Soviets left and American aid began to simmer down, and eventually the United States just dropped Afghanistan like a hot potato, which is also one reason why we have such a problem today, the Pakistanis went on trying to impose their own man on Afghanistan by, this is Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, by conducting a conventional war, which was disastrous. A lot of people got killed. And then came the battle for Kabul between Gulbuddin Hekmatyar and Ahmad Shah Massoud, which lasted 2 or 3 years, and in which over 50,000 people were killed. And one of the reasons why the Taliban began to rise up was because many ordinary Afghans were so fed up by the infighting, which was a lot of it provoked by the Pakistanis, amongst the former Mujahideen. They wanted security, and the Taliban offered security in their own way. Of course, when the Taliban came to power, once again, supported by the Pakistanis just changed their support from Gulbuddin to the Taliban. They established their own regime, and then the Pakistan, with the ISI, but also more actively with the military, heavily and massively supported, together alongside with Al-Qaeda, supported the Taliban against Massoud. And, you know, even up to 9/11 and the U.S. bombing in October 7th, 2001, the Pakistanis had a huge military presence, which they claimed to be were mainly retired military soldiers, but in fact they were active, and they were also using the Air Force. And after the bombing, the U.S. gave the ISI 3 days to evacuate all their people from Afghanistan before they really clamped down.
Talk a little bit about that nexus between Al-Qaeda and the Taliban.
Yeah, I think one of the things which, you know, we in the West find very difficult to understand is that the Taliban were like any other faction in Afghanistan. They would accept help from anyone. And the role of players from the outside with their own agendas, from the Americans, the Chinese, the Iranians, the Pakistanis, the Saudis, this role, they kept changing in the sort of merry-go-round of outside support. And Afghans have always accepted, regardless which faction, have always accepted money or weapons from whoever was willing or stupid enough to give it to them, depending how you look at it. Al-Qaeda was one of these groups that promised a lot of money, also, you know, satellite phones, cars, and whatnot. They also provided the funding which enabled a lot of the Taliban to buy off commanders, their opposition commanders, rather than actually fighting them. I mean, the Taliban very rarely fought a major battle. They usually bought off the commanders, and this was using Al-Qaeda money. I think the big mistake was that when the U.S. intervened, along with Britain and other coalition countries, they confused the Taliban with Al-Qaeda. The Taliban were not a terrorist organization. They were a faction in a rather brutal and bloody civil war. Al-Qaeda was something else. And I think the Talib leadership, 20 or 30 people, probably had some understanding or knew what was happening. But the average Talib, the uneducated, illiterate, probably had no idea and also probably couldn't care less.
And in fact, one of the things that you talk about is the average Afghanistan resident really knew very little about what was going on in terms of some of these conflicts.
Exactly. I mean, many, the Taliban basically were fighting their own war, but there were so many outsiders coming in that I think by 2001, by early 2001, there was actually a new coalition being formed by Massoud, together with a highly influential Pashtun former commander from the Soviet era, Abdul Haq. They were creating this whole new anti-Talib alliance, which actually consisted of a lot of tribesmen who had formerly supported the Taliban because they were fed up with the dominance of the Pakistanis and the dominance of Al-Qaeda and the Arabs. So there was a whole readiness to switch sides, and this was being dealt with in 2001. And in fact, when Massoud went to Paris, his first visit to the West, he actually met with U.S. officials in Paris and warned them, firstly, that Al-Qaeda was preparing a major operation against the West, probably the United States, and secondly, not to intervene but to bring pressure on the Pakistanis to stop their support because the Taliban were in the process of imploding. And I think that's also one reason why Al-Qaeda, they wanted to give a present to the Taliban by getting rid, by assassinating Massoud. But I think they were also concerned that the Taliban was in the process of collapsing from within and may have actually collapsed within a few months afterwards. So here is this completely ignored. I mean, there were some CIA operatives, some State Department people who were trying to persuade Washington to take this into account, but they were ignored because, you know, after the events of 9/11, and also Abdul Haq, by the way, was killed with a bomb. He was murdered by the Taliban. But with 9/11, there was so much emotion and anger and this need for revenge that the Bush administration basically decided to bomb and thus actually stimulate and incite a new war.
Right. We'll talk about that in terms of our immediate post 9/11 reaction when we went in after the Taliban and how that shifted things on the ground in Afghanistan and arguably made matters worse over the long run.
Yeah, I think they definitely made matters worse. I mean, I think one lesson we've learned from history, particularly Cold War, post-Cold War, is that you should not intervene in a civil war, because if you intervene in a civil war too much, I mean, obviously there were proxy wars going on, but basically what this enabled was the Northern Alliance came into Kabul, placed a lot of their own people, and for the Pashtuns, many of whom had supported the Taliban, they saw this as the West imposing their own people in Afghanistan. And under the previous attempt by Massoud, who was a northerner, and by Abdul Haq, who was from the east, to try and create this broad alliance, it would have prevented any dominance by any one group. But we also went in there and imposed warlords and imposed a lot of the old guard, the Peshawar politicians, who had become completely discredited amongst ordinary Afghans. So I think a lot of Afghans who actually welcomed the international intervention and thought, finally, an end to the war, finally, you know, a new peace, a chance to rebuild. But when they saw all these warlords being put into place, all these, you know, old guard from the jihad era who didn't have any credibility amongst ordinary Afghans, they felt, you know, this is not what they wanted. And they also felt that they were being ignored by the U.S., by the international community. A lot of the promised aid that was supposed to go to rebuilding Afghanistan simply did not happen. A lot of provincial Afghans, where, I mean, 80% of the population lives in the countryside, they simply did not see the change that was promised, became very bitter, very angry, and this whole new surge of, you know, against the West began to occur. And it doesn't mean they liked the Taliban. I think a lot of them have no other option. They have one foot in the Western camp, one foot in the Talib camp. They're basically trying to survive. But they also know that the ones who are going to probably hang on will be more likely the insurgents rather than the U.S. forces or NATO forces.
How much of a desire is there right now to bring back some sense, some era of tranquility once again?
Oh, I think it's overwhelming. Ordinary Afghans, and you know, when I say ordinary Afghans, these are the ones who don't benefit from all the privileges, the money from the internationals, but also resentment against, still ongoing resentment against the Pakistanis and the Iranians for their constant meddling. I think ordinary Afghans are just so tired of war, they just want to see recovery. And I think this is where the key lies, in a sense, that it's got to come back to talking. Afghans are very good at talking. The talking may take months and months, if not years, but they do talk. They sit down, they drink tea, and, you know, the irony is that a lot of these people, they know each other, whether they're on the government side, whether they're on the Talib side or the Hezbi Islami side. I mean, we can't really talk about Taliban anymore. You have to more or less refer to it as the armed opposition because there's so many disparate groups involved. But probably the overwhelming majority are willing to sit down and talk. The only major glitch in this is that a lot of the new Taliban, these are young commanders who were probably born, the Afghans, probably born in Pakistan and probably brought up in madrasas, these Islamic schools. They no longer have an affinity or a respect for the old traditions or these old institutions, which did enable people to sit down and drink tea and talk with each other. And the fact that the drone predators of the U.S. have been extremely successful in wiping out mid-level commanders we are ironically wiping out the very people we need to be talking to, because the new generation of commander, the 21-year-old, the 22-year-old, he's much more hardline, not willing to talk, and even more so, willing to die in this jihad. So in a sense, we're making that much more difficult, but there are still institutions which, despite being ravaged after 30, 35 years of war, could be and are being resuscitated in many areas that would enable people of different groups and different affiliations to actually sit down and talk peace.
What should the West be doing at this point?
Well, personally, now I'm talking as a writer as opposed to a journalist, because journalists, you're always holding back what you really think. But I think that the military option makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. I think now we have almost as many Americans and NATO troops killed in Afghanistan as were killed in 9/11 in the States. Over 20,000 Afghans as well killed. Nothing is being achieved by this military option. What can be done, however, is to go back to the basics. Go back to where you were in 2001 or 2002, and really focus intelligently on development of the countryside, investment, private investment as well, but in a very low-key manner, with projects or with initiatives that work, not by pouring hundreds of millions of dollars at one particular area, but really sitting down and thinking, what is going to work? And the precedent is there. There are numerous aid agencies like CARE, the Swedish Committee for Afghanistan, the Aga Khan Foundation. I can go down the list. These are people who have been working in Afghanistan for years, and their primary success does not rely on armed security, which is what many of the private contractors have. But they rely on links with the local communities. They talk with everyone. They talk with NATO. They talk with the Afghan government. They talk with the insurgents. They talk with the local elders and the local communities. And that's the only way to get things done. But it's very time-consuming. You've got to drink a lot of tea, and it could take years. But that, in a sense, is the only way it's going to really work. And that is not what we were prepared to do in 2002, 2003. We wanted quick fixes. We wanted everything to happen, over the next 2 or 3 years. And, of course, it didn't happen. And there were a lot of people in 2002 who had this long-term experience, journalists, aid workers, people within the State Department who had known Afghanistan with USAID. They were saying, go slow. Don't pour money at the situation. Move intelligently, and above all, don't get the military involved. But it did. And, we just seemed to sort of look at every possibility that could have worked, and we ignored it.
And one final thing that certainly is changing and seems to be having some influence as things evolve is the role of women who have been oppressed for so long.
Yeah, I think in some ways it's a lot better for women, but you get a lot of nostalgia for the 1970s during the communist period and the pre-communist period, when actually Kabul, women were probably never freer as they were then. A lot of people within the Afghan government today are far more conservative than even many of the Taliban, and this I think is a surprise to many people. For Afghan women, particularly urban women, it's become increasingly difficult. Even in Herat, in western Afghanistan, I remember my wife went there, and she was working for the World Health Organization at the time. She was a former journalist. And I had met the director of the local TV station, who she had met a week earlier, and I didn't know this at the time, but he had a western suit, a three-piece suit, very educated, working with the government, and he had insisted that my wife put on a head covering, which he didn't have, so she put on a plastic weather map over her head so he would talk with her. And this was a supposedly westernized Afghan representing the government, So the fact is, we can say it's better with the government or better, with the Taliban. I think when you're looking at women, more girls are going to school than before. And also, even the conservative tribesmen, they understand that if they want to have doctors taking care of their women, these doctors have got to be women, female doctors. They want to have a male doctor doing that. But how are you going to get female doctors? They have to be educated. So you can actually be persuasive, and you can bring about change, but it's very slow, and you've got to do it without labeling, saying, this guy's a Talib, we won't talk to him. You have to talk with people as individuals.
It is clear that whatever happens, it is going to be slow, painful progress, certainly.
Absolutely. But, you know, I'm a born optimist, and I'm also a romantic about Afghanistan. And I think the one major asset of the Afghans is they are the most extraordinarily resilient people. I mean, you think that they can't get battered even more, and yet they can be. And yet somehow they always manage to come up. They take initiatives on their own. They can do things. But right now, my feeling is that they're extremely tired, and the war fatigue has set in. There's also a heavy degree of war trauma, and you know this has to be overcome. But we can't do it for them. It's got to be the Afghans on their own. I think all that we can do is really help them, but do it in a manner that makes sense.
Edward Gerardet, his book is Killing the Cranes, a reporter's journey through 3 decades of war in Afghanistan. Edward, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Absolutely. No problem. I enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
We'll take a break.
Bye-bye.
I'll be right back.